Trigger warning. This episode contains details from an autopsy report and descriptions of violent injuries to the victim. Please listen with discretion. Also, stick around after the credits to hear some behind-the-scenes audio of what it really sounds like when you're in a car for days investigating a decades-old murder. Social media can be weird. You will post or tweet all kinds of serious important things day and night, but the thing that ends up going viral is a silly thought or observation that strikes a chord that you didn't expect. That's what happened to me when I tweeted this nearly 4 years ago. Me to my children. I would kill and die for you. Also me to my children. I am not your damn maid and will burn all the shit on your bedroom floors in a massive bonfire and dance around the flames in glory and rage. This tweet got almost 2.5 million engagements and ended up in viral Facebook posts and random articles all over the internet. Not because it was profound in any sense, but because parents around the world totally understand where I was coming from. Especially the I would kill and die for you part. Because most of us parents, well, we would, right? We would kill and die for our kids. But the real question is, what else would we do? How far would we go to protect them? Parents have lots of terrible fears when it comes to their kids, and most of these fears revolve around not being able to protect our babies when they need us. But imagine this nightmare, that you do everything in your power to protect your child, only to have your involvement possibly doom them. That's what it seems like happened in this case, the state of New Hampshire versus Jason Carroll. Carroll was convicted of the 1988 murder of a woman named Sharon Johnson, based on one single piece of evidence, his own confession. It was a confession tormented out of him, and a confession that he may not have ever given if his mother didn't beg him to. That's right, his own mother begged her son to confess to murder. Ironically, in order to try and save him. And why not? After all, what won't a parent do for their child? Welcome to Undisclosed. This is The State versus Jason Carroll. My name is Rabia Chaudhry. I'm an attorney and author of the New York Times bestseller, A Non-Story. And I'm here with my colleagues, Susan Simpson and Colin Miller.
Hi, this is Susan Simpson. I'm an attorney in Washington, D.C., and I blog at The View from LL2.
Hi, this is Colin Miller. I'm an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and I blog at Evidence Prof Blog. Larry Young, a heavy equipment operator, was the first to arrive to work on the morning of July 29, 1988, in the Randolph Woods area of Bedford, New Hampshire. It was a new development, and so far only one house had been built, right at the entrance to the community, which was surrounded by woods on all four sides. It was a rather remote area, about 2 miles and three winding roads from a main street. Young was hauling a massive Komatsu excavator on a trailer up a gravel road through the open construction area. And as the road curved to the left, it also inclined slightly. Parts of the road were muddy and wet, and it was dotted with small puddles. There were dirt embankments that ran for the last couple of 100 feet on both sides of the road until it dead-ended at the shallow pond. Young drove the truck as far as he could take it and then stopped. He got out and unloaded the excavator from the trailer in order to drive it closer to the pond, where he was supposed to drop it off. As the machine crawled up the last few dozen feet toward the pond, Larry suddenly noticed what looked like scuff marks in the gravel. He kept going, not too concerned, assuming a bunch of deer had come through and left the marks. Young drove another few feet, but then suddenly hit the brakes when he thought he saw a dummy lying in the dirt. A moment later, he realized it might not be a dummy at all. Young stepped down from the excavator and carefully hopped over the scuff marks to take a closer look. It was the body of a woman lying parallel to the pond, her head pointing toward the excavator. His fears confirmed, Young walked back in the same path, trying not to disturb the scene when he noticed pools of blood. He also saw that the scuff marks stretched in a line from the woman's body all the way underneath the excavator, as if she'd been dragged from that spot about 20 feet to where she was left. He had driven and parked right where the scuff marks began. Young walked down the path to his truck and reached for his CB radio to call his boss, who in turn called the police at 8:39 a.m. As Young waited for someone to arrive, he leaned down to peer under the machine and saw a wristwatch and a pair of broken glasses ground into the dirt, and a single shoe caught under an excavator track. He backed away and waited, and within 10 minutes, at 8:49 a.m., an officer from the Bedford Police arrived in the scene and was soon joined by officers from the New Hampshire State Police.
The crime scene was spread across over 50 feet, all of it in a construction area that was basically enclosed, aside from the southeast corner where a dirt road led into it. On the left side of the pond, if you were facing it, as Larry Young had been when sitting on his machine, stood a huge pile of dirt from the excavation. On the right side of the pond was raised land. The spot was virtually hidden unless you came all the way up the gravel road and right up to the pond. Investigators found themselves having to avoid the sides of the road as they approached the crime scene because it was so wet and muddy from rain the day before. The victim's body lay to the left of the excavator and south of the pond, with her feet pointing towards the large dirt pile and her upper area oriented towards the pond. She was on her back, and her body, including her curly brown hair, was covered in dirt and blood. Her feet were resting on a patch of damp mud, her left hand was tucked under her body, and her right arm was stretched outwards. Her shirt was missing, and she wore blue socks, denim pants that were partially unbuttoned on the right side, and a bra that was open in the front, exposing her chest. One gray moccasin shoe lay on the ground beneath her feet. It was clear that she had been stabbed repeatedly in the chest area. The left side of her pants were scuffed up with dirt. Her left arm had a scrape mark on it, and sand and small stones were seen stuck to the victim's upper right bicep. There was blood around her mouth, and a reddish-brown blood-soaked stain in the dirt to the right side of the body. The scuff marks in the gravel were hard to miss, and they showed a clear path from where the excavator now stood to the body. At trial, Larry Young would testify that the marks were spread as far and wide as the excavator machine itself, which was roughly 11 feet wide and 18 feet long. It was, as he said, a very big area of scuffing, and it was clear that a struggle had taken place. The scuffs weren't the only marks in the ground. Roughly 25 feet in front of the excavator, right by the pond, were tire tracks from a standard vehicle, and according to Young, he saw footprints that were definitely not his. At least, that's what Young testified to around 2 years later, but a report taken the same day by an officer specifically noted that, quote, no footprints were observed by crime scene technicians in the area of the crime scene. It turned out that the excavator had not only driven right over the origin point of the scuff marks and over some car tracks, it had also rolled right through a pile of blood. The excavator was moved to see what else might be under there, and investigators found a second moccasin, a Bulova wristwatch, and three rings. An engagement ring, a wedding band, and a gold ring with blue and white stones. Next to the excavator were the crushed glasses with one lens popped out that Young had seen earlier.
and under the machine, they found more reddish-brown blood stains soaked into the earth. One of them was nearly 2 feet in diameter, indicating a fairly big amount of blood loss.
It seemed to investigators that the initial attack on the victim happened where the machine stood, and then she was dragged to the dirt pile. There was another possibility, though, that maybe she had been killed elsewhere and her body was driven to the spot, taken out of the vehicle where the scuff marks began, and then dragged to the dirt pile. The police worked with two dental hygienists to take casts of the tire prints as other techs gathered the scattered evidence from the ground. Shortly after noon, the victim's body was removed by funeral home attendants and transferred to the medical examiner's office at the Concord Hospital. It was received there by New Hampshire State Chief Medical Examiner Dr. Roger Fossum. Now, if that name sounds familiar to you, it means you know your true crime. Dr. Fossum was state's witness in the trial that convicted Pamela Smart, one of the most notorious cases to come out of New Hampshire. Now, this wouldn't take place until a few years after the current crime scene unfolded, but Dr. Fossum was already well-respected in the field, having been the very first chief medical examiner ever appointed in the state in 1986. Fossum is credited for building the entire office of the chief medical examiner from the ground up, and today there are multiple awards named after him that are given out annually by different agencies. Murders don't happen every day in New Hampshire, and almost never in the upscale town of Bedford, so it was no surprise that the body was going to be examined by the chief medical examiner himself. Dr. Fossum began his work at 2 p.m., just hours after the victim was found, and the autopsy report determined the following.
The woman weighed 150 pounds and was 5 foot 6 inches tall. She was wearing a beige bra stained with blood that had been sliced open in the front. Her blue jeans had side closures and mud stains on both the left leg and right knee area, and she was wearing gray and blue socks, one gray moccasin shoe, and a white pair of underwear. Her jeans and underwear weren't the regular kind, though. They were maternity jeans and maternity underwear. The woman was pregnant, 7 months along, and the baby had also died. The victim's body was covered in a large amount of sand and mud. More of it stuck in the left than the right side. Her face was swollen and had a clear contusion on the right side, and spotted with a numeral petechia, small red spots caused by broken capillary vessels under the skin. It was clear to Dr. Fossum that she'd been beaten on the right side of her head and face. There were multiple abrasions on her neck and what looked like a 3-inch-long linear mark across it, perhaps from a ligature. An internal examination confirmed what Dr. Fossum suspected, that she had been strangled. There were multiple strap muscle hemorrhages and a fracture on the thyroid cartilage, and her tongue had been bitten in a number of places. Self-inflicted wounds that likely happened as she struggled to breathe. Strangulation wasn't the only cause of death, though. She had also been stabbed 13 times in her chest and once in her back. Of the 13 wounds in the front, only 3 had gone deep enough to puncture through the chest wall and into the lung cavity, none of which injured the lung deeply. The single stab in the back, however, did penetrate the lung and cause massive internal bleeding. According to the autopsy report, the wounds were dull on one edge and sharp on the other, consistent with having been made with a single-edge blade, likely a utility knife. Dr. Fossum determined the cause of death to be both manual strangulation and multiple stab wounds, and the manner of death to be homicide. The victim had fought back. She had defensive wounds on both of her hands, including stab wounds in the webbing of her left hand, as she had tried to protect herself. The toxicology report was clear, showing no intoxicants in her system, and her stomach was empty. Her time of death was established as between 6 p.m. and 12 a.m. the night before, on July 28, 1988. As Dr. Fossum conducted the autopsy, 30 miles away, the police were still at the scene of the crime, searching for additional evidence. The news about the body spread quickly, and by 2 p.m., news crews were already on the scene. Thank you.
2:45 that afternoon, two witnesses showed up at the crime scene to report that they'd been there the night before, and they had seen something. Nancy Skull and her husband Kevin Doherty had picked up their son from Chuck E. Cheese's in Manchester, about 15 minutes away, at about 8:30 the prior night. They decided on the way home that they'd swing by the construction site in Randolph Woods to check on the progress of the property they'd bought there. They drove up the gravel road towards the pond, arriving sometime between 8:45 and 9 p.m., but they stopped when they saw a car parked in the dark with all of its doors closed, near the pond but not facing it. According to diagrams from the police files, they'd been roughly 40 to 50 feet from the car and didn't go any closer. They had both thought there might have been a couple in the car, maybe lovers who were spending some time together, because in the past, when they'd gone by the construction site, they had found pornographic material and newspaper ads from people looking for sexual partners that had been discarded there. Nancy and her husband weren't sure what kind of car it had been, and they couldn't agree on the color. Nancy thought the car was small and red, but Kevin thought it was possibly a dark blazer. Another witness, Tom Jan, came forward shortly thereafter and reported that he'd been out jogging between 8:30 and 9 the night of the murder, headed in the direction of the road leading to the construction site, when he had witnessed a small car with two people in it come towards him and then make a U-turn. Neither of these three witnesses reported seeing any other vehicles in the area at the time, but given their timelines, they may have seen the same car, and it could have been the car that drove the victim to the site, dead or alive.
At 10:15 a.m. on Friday, July 29th, 1988, roughly 90 minutes after a woman's body was found in a construction site in Bedford, a call came in to the Bow, New Hampshire police dispatch. A man named Kenneth Johnson was calling to report that his wife, 36-year-old Sharon Johnson, may be missing. He wasn't sure if she was, but he had gotten a call from her workplace saying that she hadn't shown up that morning. According to Ken, he had last seen his wife Sharon the previous day when he'd met her for lunch at her workplace. Sharon Johnson worked at the Digital Corporation in Amherst, New Hampshire, about 25 miles from their home. After meeting with her, Ken had returned home and the evening waited for her to get back from work, but had eventually fallen asleep. He woke up in the morning when the call came from Digital that Sharon had not come in. When he was asked by the woman calling whether Sharon had come home at all the night before, Ken said he didn't think so, but he wasn't sure. He hadn't seen the clothes she was wearing the day before anywhere in the house, which he should have if she had come in late, changed, and then left again before he woke up. He told the police that Sharon had on, quote, pregnant pants and a pregnant shirt with animals or something on it the last time he saw her. She had a car, a green four-door Subaru, that she drove to work in the day before, and presumably drove away in as well. Just then, as he was talking to the Bow police, Ken got a call on the other line and briefly switched over. When he came back, he told the officer that it was the woman from work again. She had called again to tell him that Sharon had left work the night before between 6:15 and 6:30 p.m., and that also he should maybe try to call the Massachusetts State Police because Sharon was planning on buying Megabucks lottery tickets just across the state line that night. Ken, however, had not called the Massachusetts State Police, but he told the officer that he had made a call to the New Hampshire State Police that morning. They had told him to wait a couple of hours, and then if she didn't show up, to call his local police station, which is what he was doing now. Sharon, he explained, was pregnant, and it was a complicated pregnancy, so Ken was wondering if he should call around to hospitals, but he didn't know where to call. The officer on the other end of the line told Ken that they'd put out the call on this missing persons report and then get back to him.
At 10:30 a.m., an attempt to locate bulletin was issued statewide to the police, with a description matching the unknown victim in Bedford, a brown-haired woman with glasses, about 5'6" tall, and pregnant. The officer at the crime scene in Bedford learned of the missing persons report almost as soon as the bulletin went out, and lead investigator Detective Sergeant Thomas Morency placed a call to the Bow Police to get more information. According to Detective Morency's report, written on the same day after speaking to Bow Police, while Kenneth Johnson may have called in his wife missing, it was actually a co-worker of Sharon who had raised the red flag and urged Ken to do so. Carleen Webb was a quality control auditor at Digital and worked closely with Sharon Johnson, who worked as a quality control technician. On the morning of July 29th, Carleen arrived to work early, before 7 a.m., and expected to see Sharon there as well. When Sharon, who was never late to work, hadn't shown up for the next 90 minutes, Carleen called Sharon's house and spoke to Sharon's husband, Ken.
So the morning that she didn't show up to work, you started calling the house. She was supposed to show up around 7, I think, right?
She was pretty prompt. She was always there early, you know, probably even before me. I can't remember exactly. Yeah. I had a young boy at the time, toddler, so it was a little bit harder to get to work. Yeah. But she was very punctual. She was very punctual.
That was Carleen Webb, who was the first to notice that Sharon was missing, and also testified at the murder trial, speaking to us this summer about what she recalled of that morning.
Well, this is a copy of the calls that you made from your desk that day. Mm-hmm. And the first call you made that morning at 6:43 a.m. So you were there pretty early, but it was not to her number. 8:47 a.m. is the first call to her house. It lasts about 5 minutes. So do you have any recollection of, or did this help you remember anything about that first call? And did you just call wondering if she's coming in or she's sick or why?
I was concerned. I thought she's 7 months pregnant and she's so punctual. And if she wasn't going to be somewhere, she'd be calling me saying why she was running late. And so I called the house finally because I thought maybe I should or shouldn't do this, mind my own business type of thing. But I was concerned. She's 7 months pregnant. If she's broken down or she
maybe
needs
her husband
help,
doesn't know. Right.
Right. Exactly. Right. So I called the house.
When she called the house, she'd been hoping to learn that Sharon was still home. When Ken made it clear that Sharon wasn't there, Carleen hung up with a bad feeling about the whole thing. She urged Ken to call the police, but according to Carleen, Ken didn't seem to be interested in doing so. That information certainly didn't sit well with Detective Morency, who left immediately to talk to Carleen and other employees at Digital in person. Carleen explained that she had last seen Sharon the day before at work, and that Sharon had told her she was planning on working until about 5:30, but would see her early the next day. Sharon was usually at work by 7 a.m., and when she still hadn't shown up by 8:30 a.m., Carleen got concerned. She called Sharon's house at 8:47 a.m., and Ken picked up. Carleen asked if Sharon was there, and Ken said no, and then hung up the phone. She called back and asked him not to hang up, and once again probed him about whether Sharon was home. Ken told her he didn't know anything, didn't know if Sharon was at the house or not, whether she had even come home the night before. Ken told Carleen he had waited up until 1 a.m., or maybe it was 2 or 3 a.m., for his wife to come home, and then had fallen asleep on the couch. According to Ken, he had spoken to Sharon when she was still at work the evening before, and she told him she was going to run some errands, go to the bank, and then go buy some Megabuck lottery tickets before coming home. Carleen wasn't satisfied. She asked him to check the bathroom to see if there were any wet towels, insisting he look for clues that his wife had perhaps come in late at night and then left before he woke up. The day before, he told her, everyone in the house had put away their clothes and personal items in closets because the house was going to be bombed with insecticide. As far as he could see, all of Sharon's clothing was still put away. Carleen was getting frantic as it started to dawn on her that Sharon had never made it home the night before, but Ken's tone was remarkably unconcerned.
Immediately after talking to him, I thought, I don't know. He was just too calm, just like not.
So you said to him, she's not at work. Is she home? And he was like,
yeah, well, he kept trying to answer questions with in the statement that, you know, they had sprayed for insects and I think he said there were two wet towels. You know, just everything he said really wasn't resonating with me as to someone that's, I would be upset. Like, and yet I felt like he was trying to
downplay.
Yes. Like, you know, don't worry about it. There's two wet towels. You know, I thought you know, I didn't hear her come in. You know, I fell asleep, that type of thing. And she leaves very early, so I missed her. And I'm thinking, no, someone doesn't come home and leave the house and you don't know about it. I just felt like it was very strange.
Ken told her to call back in an hour, and she did, at 9:57 a.m. At that point, Carlene told Ken he needed to call the police. After all, even if Sharon had come home the night before and left super early, that meant she still hadn't made it to work, and something was wrong. Strangely enough, though, Ken didn't want to call the police. "You call the police," he told Carlene. She wasn't sure what to make of that, so she hung up and consulted another coworker, who said absolutely not. Ken was the person who should call to make a missing person report. So she called Ken back 10 minutes later at 10:02 and again at 10:14, insisting he call the police. That's when Ken finally made the call mentioned earlier, at 10:15 a.m. Carlene would call Ken twice more, just to see if there had been any news. In total, she called Ken 6 times that morning, searching for Sharon.
I just felt like he wanted me to go away, like, stop asking me questions. You know, I just felt like he had to share information in a way that it seemed plausible, almost like this is normal, you know, and
like you shouldn't be so worried.
Yeah, like I shouldn't be so worried. And I was very concerned.
Over the course of those calls, Ken told Carlene that he'd already checked back roads near his house for Sharon and had called the state police. The second to last time she called, at 10:44, he had told her that he was on the phone with the Bow Police Department making a report. When she called back a minute later, at 10:45, he told her that he was on the phone with Sharon's father. At that point, Carlene realized she wasn't going to get anywhere further with Ken and placed a call herself to the convenience store in Tingsboro, Massachusetts, where Sharon often went to buy lotto tickets, which also turned out to be a dead end. The only other thing that Carlene was able to offer to the police was that Sharon was very close to a woman named Kathy Hampson and called her every day. It was possible that Kathy might have more information to give them. Investigators next spoke to Arthur Young, another co-worker of Sharon's who corroborated Carlene's account. When he had left work at 6:15 p.m. the night of the murders, Sharon had still been there. There was some work they needed to wrap up together, but she told him that she had to head out soon to do some shopping, cash a check, and pick up lotto tickets. She promised to come in early the next day, though, to finish up work with him. But then she never showed up. The very last person to see Sharon at work the previous day had been a coworker named Ed Sanders, who told police that Sharon was the second to last person to leave work, after which he himself had closed up the shop. Sharon had told him that she was going to meet a friend to go shopping for her baby, and she'd left wearing washed-out blue jeans, gray moccasin shoes, a shirt with a bear and baby rattles on it, and a blue jacket. He wasn't exactly sure what time she'd left, but it was by 6:30 p.m.
At this point, less than 4 hours have passed since Sharon Johnson's body was discovered, but the police already have reason to be focused on her husband. That's because it seems he's already not being truthful. First, he told Carlene that he was on the phone with the Bow Police Department when she called him at 10:44 a.m. His phone call to the Bow Police, however, took place at 10:15 a.m., and while we don't have audio of the call, we do have the transcript. And my husband and I ran through it together, with me playing Ken's part and my husband playing the dispatcher's part. It took only 6 minutes to get through the transcript, which means Ken's call to the police could not have gone on until 10:44 a.m. It should have been over by 10:21, or even if you doubled the time it took us to get through the transcript, it would have ended by 10:27 a.m. But there's also another reason we know that he wasn't on the call with Bow Police when Carlene called at 10:44 a.m. That's because after he hung up with the Bow Police, and he only called them once, that's when he called the New Hampshire State Police. We know this because of a written report by State Trooper Terry Markle that states that he received a call from a man, presumably Ken Johnson, at 10:30 a.m. asking if there had been any car accidents because his wife was missing. The trooper told him that he wasn't aware of any, but that he should contact the state police headquarters, and then he gave him the number. So we know Ken was lying to Carlene when he told us he was on the phone with Bow Police when she called him at 10:44 a.m., but you might not have caught the other lie here. You might recall when Ken called the Bow Police Department at 10:15 a.m. to report his wife missing, he told the dispatch officer that he had called the New Hampshire State Police already. Not only that, he told the dispatcher that the state police told him to wait an hour or two before calling the local precinct. But State Trooper Markell's report and Ken's own phone records tell us that Ken had not called the state police at all until after he hung up the phone with Beau. Like I said, at this point, only a few hours have passed since Sharon Johnson was found murdered, but her husband already couldn't get his story straight. And it would only get worse over the course of the day, when police first visit Ken to take a missing persons report, and then later show up to tell him that his wife had been found murdered. Next time on Undisclosed. Any information related to this or any of the cases we cover, remember you can reach us on our phone line at 410-205-5563. Once again, that's 410-205-5563. As always, a big thank you to Baluki for our logo, to Patrick Cortez for our theme music, and of course to Mithil Thelhan for keeping the ship tight and the ball rolling as our executive producer. A special thanks to my research assistant, Jennifer Leahy, and her mom, and homicide investigator, Sarah Kalin, who spent way too long in a car with me driving around New Hampshire.
Well, I'll fill you in on how it went this morning. Yeah, so we... You're rolling?
Yeah.
Okay. I am too. So, we both need the audio. So yeah, we met with Carly Webb and her husband, and they were lovely. And then we went over her call records and what she remembered. She didn't remember details of like what the calls were like. What she remembered was that he wasn't concerned when she called. Like the first time she called, he was like, call me back in an hour. And she'd call back a little over an hour later. She called him like 6 or 7 times like that morning. And each time she said, he just made it seem like this, you know, Sharon does this. She already left this morning early before I got up and I'm not concerned. And what else did she say? Yeah, she just said that she just didn't get a sense that he really cared.
She said that he was sort of trying to explain it away as like, well, she must have gone to work because she must have just left so early. I didn't see her go to work. And she was trying to reiterate, well, okay, but she's not at work. So
right.
If she's not in these two places.
Where is she?
Maybe she's even broken down on the side of the road. She said, you know, but she's 7 months pregnant. She needs help wherever she is.
Yeah.
And that she couldn't get a reaction from him that mirrored that.
Yeah. So 8:45 was when she first called him. He did not call the police until about 10:45. So he let a bit of time lapse. And I'm wondering what was happening in that hour.
Mm-hmm.
So the interesting thing is he told somebody, in one of the reports, he said that he called the police and he was told to call back an hour later and that had not happened. He actually had told her, I'll call back an hour later, which is confusing.
Yeah, right now we are going to Thomas Sexton, who was an investigator, I believe. And then the other one that I had put in here was the second address for Guy Kimball, but he's deceased.
So he's gone. Then is that all we have? No, we have,
that was all.
I always have more. Let me tell you. Actually, let's get to this address and then we'll get this. I don't want to do this one.
Yeah, this one's like half an hour.
Okay.
Maybe can I get some ice cream afterwards?
Of course. Okay. You've earned it. You could also get some local meats.
There's some corn. If my husband was here, he would not only buy pies, he would take them home.
Buy what?
Pies.
Oh, the pies.
God,
he carried, we took like 5 pies from this place in Leesburg, which is an hour and a half away. He drove there, hour and a half each way to buy 5 pies to take to Toronto. Because he loves pies so much, and he wanted to share it with his family.
What kind of pies were they?
They were fine. They were just like apple crumb.
Oh.
But if a pie comes into our house 3 days later, it is gone without anybody having touched it.